coming to you from the Sherpa Chalet at the top of beautiful downtown Mount Podcastia. It's a special episode of Too Many Podcasts. I'm Jim, the podcast Sherpa, and today it's a special episode where I get to speak with people from the entertainment industry. So get yourself an aisle seat, pop up some popcorn, and get a cold drink ready, and sit back. Don't crunch too loud, or else you'll miss the interview from the Sherpa Screening Room. Hey, Rebels, it's me, Jim, the podcast Sherpa. Welcome back to the Too Many Podcasts presentation of the Sherpa Screening Room. And you are listening to part two of my interview with actor Larry Henkin. If you missed the first part, check it out. He talks about his experience on Friends, working with Clint Eastwood, and his early stand-up and improvisation career. And today in part two, he talks about being on Seinfeld, his Oscar-nominated movie, and working on El Camino as Old Joe, and some of the things that he's been up to recently. So before we get into the interview, just a reminder that today's podcast is being brought to you by Audible, and you can get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at www.audibletrial.com/Sherpa. There's over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Okay, now that we've gotten that out of the way, let's head on down to the interview with Larry Henkin.
You made a short film on a dare, which ended up getting nominated for an Academy Award, which doesn't really happen too often in Hollywood, does it?
Yeah, well, see, that's really what you just said encapsulated the arc of my life. What we're talking about, all my mistakes and the screw ups and the things that I thought were bad were weren't, and blah, blah, blah. Those are the great stories, you know, because when things go wrong, that's a great story. But my life is just a patchwork of, you know, highs and lows and lefts and rights and ups and downs. And I don't keep track of them, but yeah, like what you just mentioned. Okay, so say that again. What you were interested in? What would that be like? I mean, what you asked me.
Right. I mean, it's just so I would imagine pretty unusual that you did a short film on a dare, and okay, it ended up so getting nominated for an Oscar.
Okay, so that's the opposite kind of story, but it's a great story. So yeah, somebody dared me. I never thought in a million years it would get an Academy Award, or that it would even be put up for an Academy Award, or that it would even be a finished film. What happened was a woman, Anna Mathias. Harry Mathias was a cinematographer. That was her husband. Anna Mathias was an actress who was in the committee with me as an improviser. And she came to me one day and she said, I think she was in a Pitchell Players, which is down the block, another improvising plays. We did guest spots in each other's shows. We were a couple of blocks apart. So she said to me, my husband, Harry Mathias, he's a camera operator. He wants to be a cinematographer, but he needs a reel as a cinematographer. So why don't you write a movie that he could be the cinematographer of, and he'll work for free, because he was a pro, you know, as a camera operator. He was doing big movies. He'll work for free, and he'll use his crew if you can write a movie, a film short, that, you know, he can be the cinematographer of and use his crew. So I thought that was kind of a great, not a dare, but an opportunity to work with a really professional film crew. That seemed to be okay. And I've always wanted to write something that might be put on a screen that I could do a character in. So the challenge for me, and the reason I did it, was not for Harry or his wife. It was because it might give me an opportunity to invent this character that I had been writing about in short stories called Sometimes Jones, a homeless guy about in his late 20s, which I was in my late 20s. So he's a homeless guy. And I was thinking Chaplin was homeless. So, you know, let's explore that, because there's a lot of comedy, because I grew up on Chaplin. So I knew all his setups and stuff. And if I was homeless, I could just update them, make them modern. So I could see that, but I wanted to see my character homeless on a screen. And so I took her up on it. So I wrote this thing about 20 minutes. It took me about a month, I guess. I don't know. Because I was just writing stories anyway. So it took about a month. And I went to Harry. I sent it to him, or I guess gave it to him. I would see him every now and then. And he read it that night. He called me up. He said, yeah, okay, it's too long. Cut it in half and send it. Cut it in half and send it to me. So it took me another month to cut it in half because you hate to cut anything that these jewels, these gems that you write. You got to kill your children. That's a writer's motto. Kill your children. You got to edit your work. Okay, so I finally did it. I sent it to him. He calls me. He says, okay, start rehearsing. Cast your actors. We're shooting in 2 weeks. I have my crew. We're all set to go. But it's going to cost $5,000. Do you have the $5,000? I said, I'll get it. I have some jobs coming up. I'll get it. She says, okay, we're ready. Okay. So I do a job, and I take $5,000 out of it, and I cash the check. It was about, I think I did, a month later, I got a sitcom. I took $5,000. I cashed a check for $5,000. Cash. Put it in a paper bag. I like the Beau Jest. I like to do big things because I'm so small. So I thought $5,000 is a great Beau Jest if I put it on a paper bag and just hand it to him. I thought that would be cool. So I said, okay. So I call him. I just go over his house. He's in the neighborhood. I go over to his house, and I knock on the door, and Anna comes to the door. She says, oh, hi, Larry. What is it? She says, I want to talk to Harry because I have this brown paper bag of $5,000 in cash in my hand. She says, he's eating dinner now. That was one rule we have. We're not disturbed by dinner, so you have to come back later. I said, oh, please, man. I just want to give him something. She says, you can give it to me. I said, no, I want to hand it to him myself. Please, I'll just hand it to him. I won't talk to him. So I just let me. She says, oh, all right, come on. So I just come in and I say, hi, Harry. Here. I didn't even say money. I said, here, I put it on his plate. I remember he was eating some in the middle of cutting his meat. There's weird things I remember and other things I have no idea what it was. I remember he was cutting his meat. Here, Harry, put the bag down. I said, thank you, Anna, and I split. And that was it. And then once I got outside the door and she shut the door, I said, I don't know if I should have done that because I didn't even tell him what it was for or what it was. He could just take that and not say I gave him anything, you know. Okay, fine. About you know, the next day he called me. He says, okay, we're shooting in 2 weeks. Get your cast together. So I got my cast together, and we did it. But I didn't think it would ever, because he said, who's gonna direct? And I said, well, I don't know. I got to find somebody. He said, you direct. Now, I didn't know that the reason he said you direct, and I said, I don't know how to direct. He said, I'll help you, you know, but let's not get another director. That's too much. So I said, okay, because I trusted he was going to help me. The reason he told me that was, it's all, you know, intent. The reason he told me that was because if I was a weak director, then he was going to direct the movie, and he's the cinematographer, and he's looking for a reel. So he's already, his agenda is get a great reel by directing the movie so that you have control, Harry has control, of the camera placement. So that's what he was thinking the whole time. He wasn't thinking of me or the director or the film short. And I, you know, not knowing anything, very naive, said, okay, you know. So we would have fights that were amazing on the set. I mean, enough where he would say, he finally said at one point, okay, Larry, we were losing the day, we were losing the night. It was a night shoot. It was a 3-day night shoot. And the restaurant window of Sally's Diner faced where the sun came up. So as soon as we lost the light, as soon as the sun came up, the light came through the window. We couldn't block the window. And it was supposed to be because it was a big, huge picture window. It was a night shoot. It was supposed to be a night shoot at 4 in the morning. So he said, look, man, we got to set this shot up. The sky is turning purple. If we don't put the camera where I want, where Harry Mathias wants, we have to change every, no, wait a minute. If we put the camera where you want, Larry, we're going to have to tear down this setup and we're going to lose the light because the sun's going to come up while we're changing the shot. But if we do it my way, Larry, we just shoot it this way. And I said, no. And that's when I blew up so bad that he said, you're freaking out my crew. They're going to walk. So just walk around the block. We'll leave it the way this is. We just got to reposition the camera. But get out of here. When you come back, we'll shoot it your way. I said, I don't know how it worked, but what, now, wait a minute. See, I've got it all. It would shoot, go away. We should leave it this way. This is how I want to shoot it. It'll be dark this way, but if we change the camera your way, we're facing the sun when it comes up. So get out of here. Stop yelling. You're freaking out the crew. They're going to walk if we change the shot your way. Walk around the block. I just need to make a slight adjustment to the camera. Cool down. When you come back, we'll shoot it your way. I said, okay, that's a good idea. I know I'm causing problems. I'll get out of here. So I walked around the block, calmed myself down. When I came back, it was his way. It was not my way. He had lied to me by getting me out of there. And I freaked out. But I held it very short because I knew the crew was going to walk. So I just hollered once. And then I shut up and I said, okay, let's just shoot this and get out of here. So I did. But because of that thing that I had with Harry about where to put the camera and the whole thing, I didn't want to hand, right there, right at that moment, I said, this is going nowhere. I'm burying this film because of Harry and his attitude. You know, I see now why he wanted me to direct, because he wanted to shoot it his way. So we edited it together, which was just arguments for the whole time, because he still wanted to save, you know, this is a great shot. I said, yeah, but it's nothing to do with the story. So we were shouting at one another, and finally he would give in. And then finally it was edited. And then he said, I want to hand this into the Academy. And that's when I put my foot down and I said, no, it's not going into the Academy. I mean, I was really, really nuts. As a young man in this business, I didn't know my A from my elbow. So he finally, we finished editing it. It took a long time. I threatened to burn the film several times. And no shouting. I just said, okay, Harry, but I'm going to burn the film. I mean, you know, by then I was just very calm about my anger. Yeah, well, I'm going to burn it. You know, I have the key to the editing room. We finished it, and then he calls me, and he says, look, Larry, I want to hand this into the Academy. I said, no way, man, because I was the producer. He said, no way. He said, please, I got to do this, man. I got, no. So I hung up on him. He calls me back about 2 days later, and he says, I've got good news and bad news. I said, oh, no, now what? And he says, well, the bad news is I handed it in. I go, man, why did you do that, man? Okay, what's the bad news? The bad news is it's been accepted. So I put my hand over my mouth. I put my hand over, you know, one of those, when landline phones. I put my hand over the mouthpiece, and I just went, you know, yay! Very silently, very quietly, yay! But I didn't tell him. I didn't admit it to him. I said, well, don't do that again, man. Okay, but I'm not going to complain. And then I said, fine, I'll talk to you later. So we did go to the Academy, and it was really kind of great, and I was really PO'd that we didn't win the nomination. I mean, didn't win an Academy. We got the nomination. We didn't win the award. I didn't like the film that won, but they awarded the Film Short Award to, I don't remember the name of the film, but I'll never forget the producer's name of that film, Sarah Pillsbury, because I didn't like her film and I wanted to win. We should have won. So I don't know. I guess her name was seared in my brain. I don't know the name of the film. I remember the film, but you know. And we went. But after that, after she got the award, I just wanted to go home. You know, and I had rented a limo. I had rented a tuxedo. I had bought my girlfriend a brand new, you know, dress to go to the Academy Awards. And Harry was there with. He rented a tuxedo. His wife had a new dress. The other producer had, you know, his wife there. We all went in a big stretch limo, and I just wanted to go home. I didn't win. They don't know what they're doing. You know, that was the kind of thing. You know, I guess what it is, it's called growing up. Because when I reached Hollywood, I was in my 20s, late 20s, but really, I was like about 17 or 18. I mean, my attitude, because I'd never thought about show business growing up all the way through college. You know, I was in plays, but I didn't want to be an actor. I never wanted to be anything. So when I actually became a professional actor, being paid for being on stage, making people laugh, or being in a sitcom or a movie, it was all new to me. My parents never, you know, went to movies. They weren't into movies. So it was all really like growing up all over again. You know, I was from a middle class, very uptight, right-wing, angry, passive-aggressive family. I mean, I had no family life that I can brag about. I was just a kid growing up, you know. So it was all new. And so I think all that not understanding that, you know, misunderstanding and anger because I didn't know what really was going on. I mean, how it really worked. It took me years to, you know, get my feet in Hollywood and not think that I was being fired or really enjoying the day's work, you know, joining in telling a story on film. That's cool. That's really where I'm going now. I mean, I'm writing a screenplay for myself right now. It's a comedy. It's a vampire movie. But I really enjoy writing it, and I think I'll enjoy, you know, making it because I know who I want to work with, and I know how a film is put together, and I know things. Knowing things helps anger, you know, helps dissuade anger. If you know what's going on, I don't think you get too angry, I think. I don't know.
That storytelling desire for you is definitely prevalent throughout your career. You know, I see that you know, you did, you know, things with Sometimes Jones, and you had another character called Emmett Demas. You did a one-man show called Street
One-man
Stories.
Show. Exactly.
And even a book called The Loopholes Dossier, where you were actually homeless for a year, and you wrote about that as well.
Exactly. And the first third of the book is just the short stories that got me to Sometimes Jones, the Sally's Diner hero. So all those are, you know, just funny little fables. That's what I write. I fables. Even in the Loopholes Dossier, which is the homeless part. What is Barnum Justice is the homeless guy, the star of that part of the book, where he's homeless. Even he tells fables in his. So I wrote an oral history. I wrote it. It's an oral history that's written. But even him, Barnum Justice, in the oral history, tells, and I write them out, fables to his friends. So even my characters tell fables because that's what I do. I, you know, tell fables. But because if I go really way back to when I was a child at my mother's knee, I would tell. That's what I would do. I would come home from school. I don't know. Whenever you could walk, the first time you would walk alone to school and come back, you know, whatever age that is. So she would ask me, you know, how was your day? I would tell her stories. I mean, that was my connection to my mom, was, you know, she loved to hear my stories. So telling these, you know, and it was basically my day, which is what I was doing in stand-up. I would be telling them my day, what happened that day. And what happened that day, generally, in my stand-up was sex, drugs, and rock and roll. I mean, that's what my day was. I was a 60. You know, that was my day. Now it's movies. That was what my day was. So that's what I tell audiences now. And that's what my writing is generally. Or my podcast, anyway. It's what I talk about. But yeah, stories is my thing. You know, I go on forever.
You based one of your roles on your uncle?
Oh, yeah. Old Joe was the simplest part I've ever had in my life. And that was a major role, an important role. But yeah, I had finally grown up where I understood how to be an actor, you know, like what a backstory was and how that helps and not cutting out pictures. That doesn't help too much. Oh, by the way, they made me take down those. Because in Alcatraz, the rule was you could not hang up anything in your cell. So what I was doing was wrong anyway. So when I was in my shot, in my cell, they made me take all that stuff down. The rules weren't like that. So, yeah, but when I, you know, finally became an adult, growing up as an actor, learning how to do it, yeah, by the time Old Joe came around, I used a lot of shortcuts that I picked up by questioning the stars that I worked with about, you know, how do you do this and what's that and, you know, memorization. So I found out that Old Joe, my uncle raised me as much as my parents did because they would always travel, and he and his girlfriend, later to become his wife, my uncle, would babysit. So I would stay over their house. So I would sleep over their house. I would have dinner with them. I have breakfast with them. So I got, you know, I grew up with my uncle, and he was really a cool guy. But he installed oil burners, which was very much like Old Joe being a junkyard dealer. He was always dressed in what Old Joe was dressed in. That's how you install oil burners. It's full of oil and grease, and you're working in a cellar, and you're on your knees and rolling on your back and reaching up, and it's just dirty work and carrying a lot of greasy stuff and cellar work. And because you were right next to a coal bin, where because they had coal furnaces in those cellars, because I helped them when I finally got to be about 16, I was his aide. I was his sidekick, which I hated. He was a bad boss. He was a great uncle, but a bad boss. I was 16. I didn't want it. But anyway, he was always like Old Joe. So when I got the part of Old Joe, the Old Joe originally started out as just five lines. That was all I had. So I said, well, I'll do my uncle. I'll do my Uncle Murray. So when I read the part and read what he was dressed in and what he did, you know, just, you know, tearing up cars and junking cars and crushing them and moving them. I thought, well, that's kind of, so I was just doing my uncle Murray. That was really all I did. And, you know, just using your imagination, I'm an improviser actor. In other words, an audience would call something up like, okay, bus driver, you know, in a saloon with no money. Okay, and so you just make that up on the spot. You know, you just have to, okay, I'm a bus driver in a bar and I don't have any money. Okay. And you just go with it. So that's what I would be doing with most of my characters, is just no backstory, no nothing. I would just be me in this situation, and, you know, for whatever it was worth, good or bad. I guess just people just liked me being whatever. But Old Joe, I just imitated my Uncle Murray. The same thing with Tom Pepper. By the time I got to Tom Pepper, Seinfeld, the guy who stole the raisins, how did I get that role? That was the same kind of thing. Where I didn't do any backstory. I just had it in for the guy I was talking to. I don't know that the actor's name, the short fat actor in Seinfeld
was Jason Alexander.
Yeah, Jason. Yeah, I just got an attitude towards him. I was just using my attitude about, you know, no, I, you know, don't, I didn't, I don't want to talk about dried fruit. You know, I didn't steal the raisins. That was just my attitude. I was just, but my point about that was imitating Murray. The strange thing about that part, about doing Tom Pepper, was that they handed me, when they asked me to audition, I was, I guess, semi-hemi-demi famous enough so they knew my work. I didn't have to audition. They sent me a tape of Michael Richards doing Kramer, doing an episode of Kramer. They sent me a tape of him doing the exact five lines that I was going to audition with, which was out of a script that had already been aired that Michael Richards had done as Kramer. So all they wanted me to do in the audition was to watch the tape of Michael Richards doing Kramer, saying my five lines, and then I was to do those five lines for the audition. So all I did was I just played Michael Richards doing Kramer about 100 times. I just watched it until I just was imitating him. I wasn't acting at all in that scene. I was just imitating Michael Richards. That's doing Kramer. It had nothing to do with acting. There's no backstory or why was I doing. And it worked perfectly well. So I was learning to become, as I call myself, a professional pretender. You know, I mean, like, you know, people go to acting school and they, you know, study with Uta Hagen and stuff like that. But no, I just, you know, blah, blah, blah. I'll imitate my uncle, or I'll imitate Michael Richards, or, you know, the only backstory that I really had. What? There was one thing where I even mentioned it to the director that I had a backstory. What was it for? Oh, it was for Charlie Butts. An Escape from Alcatraz. He wanted me to do something, and I didn't want to do it because I couldn't. Oh, crying, the crying scene. Can I mention that, the crying scene?
No, you didn't.
Butts? Can I tell you about that?
Sure, go ahead.
Oh, the crying scene, yeah. He came to me, and he said, the director, Don Siegel, said, you've got to, I was playing cards with the crew. We were in between shots, or they were shooting with, they didn't need as many crew guys, but I was playing cards with the crew. I wasn't going to be up for another 2 hours or so. Playing cards, they look up and there's somebody standing behind me, and it's the director. And I look up and I go, oh, hi. And he says, what are you doing, Larry? And it's Don Siegel. And he goes, oh, I'm playing cards. And he goes, well, you ready for your next scene? I go, well, yeah, but I'm not going to shoot for 2 hours. He goes, well, but it's a crying scene. And you know what the scene was? I don't know if you saw the movie, but it's where I'm left behind. They've already broken out. Everybody's kicked out their little, you know, cardboard grating. And I can't kick out mine, or I can't get out of it, or it's too small, or I'm having problems with it. And they leave. The time has passed, and I'm not even out of my cell yet. So I sit down on my cot, and I cry. So that's the scene. It's just me and myself sitting down on my cot and crying. And he's talking about it. He says, you got to cry in 2 hours. You sure you can do it? Because I need you to cry. And he's very serious. I go, yeah. Don't worry about it. He says, okay. And he says, but, you know, if you can't cry, then I think you should go into your dressing room and just slap yourself around. And he said that. Slap yourself around because I need you to cry. And then he walked away. So I said to the card players, well, I'm out now because I got to go practice crying. I didn't know what the hell that was all about because I say, you know, I'm a stand-up comedian. So I put my cards down. I go into my dressing room, and I'm trying to cry. I'm trying to think, how the hell do you cry? I didn't even know how to produce that. You know, sense memory, what the hell? So I'm slapping myself. My face is red. I'm not crying. So I find Don. I said, can I talk to you for a second? He goes, yeah, sure, Larry. What is it? He said, it's about the scene. Oh, really? What is it about? So I said, okay, now, Don, look, I'm serious. I did a backstory. See, you know, I didn't do any backstory, but I'm lying in my shoes. I'm lying in my teeth. I did a backstory, and see, in my backstory, Charlie Butts wouldn't cry in this scene. He goes, really? Is that true? Okay, just wait a minute, Larry. And he calls his secretary, Carol. She's about a woman about 28 or so. And she's his secretary. She takes notes. She, you know, blah, blah, blah. Carol, would you come over here for a second? She's over there. She's way over there, about 50 feet away. Comes over. She comes over here, yeah. She says, Larry. Larry is Carol. Carol is Larry. She's my secretary. I want you to listen to what Larry is going to tell you. Larry, tell Carol what you just told me. So I don't know what's going on. She doesn't know what's going on. So I say, well, Carol, I told him that in my backstory that Charlie Butts wouldn't cry in this scene. I did a lot of research. So he turns to her and he says, okay, Carol, what the fuck is he talking about? I need him to cry in this scene. And he looks at me, he says, Larry, I need you to cry in this scene, so you better slap yourself silly, do whatever you do. But, and then he points to the ceiling of, you know, we're in a prison. There's cells all around us. He points to the ceiling like he's pointing to the sky, and he marks with his forefinger a big arc in the sky of the cell. And he goes, I have this big arc of a movie. I'm telling a story, Larry. And it's all testosterone. And it's all guys. And they're all angry. And they all want to beat each other up and get the hell out of here. Except I need somebody to cry. And he goes to the arc 3/4 of the way through the sky. And he points and he says, right here, I need another emotion. I need somebody to cry. Guess who's there, Larry? You. I need you to cry there, Larry. See? Okay? Do you understand? And they go, yeah. And he goes, okay, thank you, Carol. Thank you, Larry. Goodbye. And he walks away. And I got like maybe 10, 15 minutes to go. And I'm thinking, what the hell am I going to do? Okay, I'm going to get fired. That was my go-to fallback position. Because I wasn't going to cry. I mean, I knew I wasn't. I couldn't. There's no that way. So I thought, well, I'm going to get fired, so I might as well calm down and get into that mode. And he says, you up, Larry? So I walk over. He sits me down in my cell, and he gets the camera. And if you see the scene, the camera is like maybe 10 inches away from my face, you know, just to make it even more tense. So, you know, the camera's there. He says, you ready to cry, Larry? And I go, yeah, sure. He goes, okay, ready? And, you know, camera, sound, and action, Larry, cry. And I go, nothing, man, nothing. Dry, totally dry. You know, he goes, okay, cut. Ralph, bring it in. I go, what the fuck is going on? And Ralph comes in. Ralph is a crew member, and he's got a bottle which looks like a perfume spritzer on the end of it. You know, in the perfume bottle, you have to squeeze things at the end. Sure. And he aims it right at my face, and he goes, psh, psh, and he walks away, and then Don goes, okay, ready, sound, camera, Larry, ready, action, and cry. And my eyes just welled up in tears, and tears poured down my cheeks. And he goes, cut. Larry, that was great, man. Terrific. Okay, moving on. Next scene. And I said, well, wait a minute. I get up. He's moving on. They're moving the camera away. They're breaking down the scene. I go, what was that all about? He said, that, Larry, was Wintergreen. And he walks away. Now, he knew that all day long. Don Siegel knew that he was going to use Wintergreen to make me cry. It's really simple. They use it in every crying scene. You know, they just, and if they do it even to start to cry, they can spray it from off camera. It'll float over to you and you'll tear up. So that's what was going on, man. I mean, that was, you know, the backstory. That's my story about that. It was the only time they ever used a backstory and he didn't believe me. And it didn't work. And I didn't even know how to use it. So, yeah, I think it's a great life. I just really love what I've been doing. Those 187 things, you can't ask for a better job. I mean, or a better life. Not a better job. I can get better jobs, but for a life, oh man, cool. You know. And then I talk about my life on stage, and that makes it even a better life because, you know, it's like completes the circle. You know.
Absolutely. And before we wrap it up, could you let everybody know some of the projects that you're working on and things that are coming out? Because I know you've still got a full plate.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Okay. So I have a website that's going up. We're building it right now. It's in beta. You can go look at it. It's not finished. But basically, it's selling my book. The book's called The Loopholes Dossier, Loopholes Plural, Loopholes Dossier by Larry Hankin. You can buy it anywhere. It's $2.99 in ebooks or Amazon. You can get it, or Barnes & Noble or any bookstore, you know, or they'll order it for you so you can get that. Okay, so there's the book. There's the website. We're going to have T-shirts on that, sell T-shirts. We're selling my art on the website. They're big time, but the T-shirts are going to be the art, which you can hang on the wall. They're about four feet by 4 feet. They're about, I don't know, anywhere from $300 to $500. But the T-shirts are really cheap. But the T-shirts have the work of art on the T-shirt. That's what the art on the T-shirt is, these big prints of, you know, 4 feet by 4 feet you can hang on your wall. They're mounted, they're framed, they're really cool. So that, and then I'm writing a screenplay. It's called, a working title, it's called It Happened One Night, A Night in the Country. Happened One Night is a real good movie. It's called A Night in the Country, and that I'm writing for myself. So that's coming up. And then I'm doing autograph cons, you know, like Comic-Con and Chiller and all these cons, you know, where you sign autographs of yourself for the fans. So I'm doing those. What else am I doing? I'm making film shorts with my friends. You know, those are always fun because you're working with your friends. And, you know, there's no risk. There's no dangers. There's no suits. There's no, you know, major, you know, production companies. It's just, and it's in the neighborhood generally. That's really fun. I mean, I wish that you could make a movie like that, like you make a short film. But there's a lot of money involved. So, you know, but anyway, that's kind of, I'll think of other things I'm doing. Let me see. What else am I doing that I can think of? No, that's enough for now. You know, and I'm also, you know, working with other people who, you know, hire me to be in their film or video or sitcom or whatever. I'm still doing that. So cool. There you go.
Okay. He is a writer, an artist, a director, a producer. And by the way, just so we put in a little extra, Old Joe is in the Netflix movie El Camino, if you want to check that movie out.
Yeah, right.
That was really good. Yeah, like I said, he's been in over 150 films and TV shows, and I'm sure you've probably seen him in several.
187.
There we go. That is the official tally. And
yeah, you said.
If you see all 187, do not call this man a method actor. But you can call him a great podcast guest. So, Larry Hankin,
okay, thank you.
Thank you so much for coming down to the Sherpa Screening Room.
Okay, thank you, Jim. James, great. Bye.
Thanks so much to Larry Hankin for coming down to the Sherpa Screening Room. Don't forget, guys, it's Hollywood Week if you're listening to this in real time, so there are shows throughout the whole week, not just Wednesdays. So if you want to follow me, you can do so on social media at Sherpalution on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram, or you can check out all the shows at my website, sherpalution.com. So speaking of people who should have their own Netflix show, Mr. Bruce, could you please show everyone the door? Thanks a lot, everybody. See you next time.
Thanks for listening to Too Many Podcasts. Please disperse. You can go home now. I said you can go home now. Viva la Sherpalution. Viva la Sherpalution. Yeah, I'll come back now you're here.